Namaste, good morning. One important announcement to make is we've just heard from a building that there will be a power outage at around 11 o'clock for maybe half an hour. So during that time, I will try to connect back on Bluetooth, but that is generally a weak signal. In which case, if that does not happen, I will be back as soon as the power returns. The estimated time is around 11, and the duration is around half an hour. But as we all know, anything can happen. But I will be here. During this gap, I will not be making telephone calls to friends and doing other things, playing video games and so on. So if you feel like sitting with your screen, you're welcome to. If you feel like having a cup of coffee, taking a break, or if you feel that's enough for the day, then that's also fine. In India, the concept of parampara means the lineage, the spiritual heritage, the spiritual lineage, the spiritual tradition. It has been given a lot of significance because it goes back in time, so to speak. What is so beautiful to see, because the parampara I am familiar with, as many of you might know, is my teacher Ramesh Balsekar, his teacher Nisargadatta Maharaj, his teacher Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj, and Siddha Rameshwar's guru, Bhav Sahib Maharaj. Now, what is fascinating is Bhav Sahib Maharaj taught Nama Japa, mantra, repetition of God's name. That was his teaching. We have to go back, I think, over 100 years perhaps. You see, when thought processes were quite different from what they are today. And depending on the aptitude of devotees and disciples and seekers, teachers would impart what they felt was the appropriate spiritual process for their unfoldment. Now, Bhav Sahib Maharaj's disciple Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj felt that if he delved deeper into meditation, into the teachings, that there was perhaps a more direct path to self-realization, to understanding. And so in that sense, it was a departure from his master's method, not teaching, method. And in time, Bhav Sahib Maharaj's teaching was referred to as the ant's way, needing the diligence of the ant, the discipline of the ant, the focus of the ant. And Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj's teaching was called the bird's way. The bird's way. As the crow flies directly from one point to the other. But the teaching is the same. And so when I was presented a very short booklet, I don't know if there's more text which is now available, of what Bhau Sahib Maharaj had said, I was quite pleasantly surprised to see the teaching of non-doership so clearly expressed in that little booklet, which, as you all know, was Rameshji's core teaching. So you see, when this lineage expresses a teaching, a concept that has stood the test of time, then it is perhaps easier to trust it. So some of you might not trust this South Bombay bloke who has been educated in Jesuit schools in Bombay. And therefore, I take the support of these great masters, and I would like to read out two or three quotations of Bhau Sahib Maharaj on non-doership from this booklet. The language is different, the style is different, the message is the same. With all our prudence, we must not fail to realize that God's will alone ultimately prevails. Hence, we should be ever ready to abide by His will. That's simple. You see, that's what I like about these great beings. The teachings are simple. I'm referring to a very old photocopied version of these teachings. We should perform our prescribed duties skillfully, intelligently, and calmly. Still, we must bear in mind that God is all-powerful and His will alone is supreme, and therefore we should behave accordingly. We must always submit to His dictates. We should not waste our life under the delusion that we are the doers. None in the past have departed by making thorough adjustment of everything behind Him. We will have to face it sooner or later. Hence, whenever we come across any difficulty in our worldly life, we must remember the Lord and discharge our duty. Never should we labor under the delusion that we are the doers. We should ever entertain the feeling that God's will prevails. In short, we should dedicate our mind, intellect, and will to the Lord. Utilize them for realizing God and submitting to His will. And lastly, the booklet ends on this. If a person realizes that God is impersonal, he will be completely free from soul consciousness and free from the consciousness that he is a devotee. He becomes impersonal and formless. He is ever immersed in God consciousness. Hence, he becomes a non-doer in both spheres of life. Both spheres means worldly life and spiritual life. He is a real devotee who experiences such a transformation. This is the final liberation through oneness. This is the final liberation through oneness. And this is the supreme end of life. You see, we celebrate our birthdays. And Osho had said that birthdays should be called birthday death day. Because when you are born, you're bound to die, you see. The polaric opposites, birth and death. We celebrate our birthdays. But the real birth is the spiritual birth. Dvija means twice born. So in your life, when you come across a teaching, a teacher, maybe a book, maybe someone, anyone, a friend, a mentor, and from that point on, you start noticing things that you did not notice before. You start looking at life. You start looking at what happened to you thus far. You start looking at all that in a different light. That is the spiritual birth. The twice born, the second birth, the dvij. Advaita, a dvait, not two, a, not Dvait, two, not two. Dvij, twice born. That is the birth to be celebrated, because that is the birth that frees one from the cycle of birth and death. Which means the cycle of birth and death of the ego with its sense of doership, its sense of me and mine, its identifications, its misconceptions, its delusions. The second birth signifies the death of all this. Which birth is the real birth? And that is why Rameshji would say, as Maharaj said, understanding is all. Understanding is all. For the seeing is the only doing necessary. Seeing things as they are, not as they should be, and not as they should have been. So the message of non-doership is not a superficial, light-hearted message. Not dinner table conversation as such. We were at a dinner a couple of years ago, and the conversation was about a spiritual teacher, a Western spiritual teacher, saying that this whole teaching of Balsekar on non-doership is kindergarten stuff. And of course, how some of those at the dinner table agreed with that. Now, by all means, spiritual teachers say things also in context. So I would not know what that context is because I was not there. There's always a reason behind saying things, maybe to break fixed thought processes of the devotees or whatever it may be. It is said with reference. But as an outsider, I found an outsider at that dinner table that all I could say was that if this teaching has gone as far back, or rather come from as far back as the Bhagavad Gita, where it is mentioned, Lord Krishna telling Arjuna that the ego deluded thinks I am the doer. How can it be kindergarten stuff? So I said, please ask the teacher. There must be a context. Maybe you were too identified with becoming a non-doer, so he needed to break that. I don't know. But living the teaching is the test. And that is why Vimlananda would say that this whole system of exams is of no use, because then students can prepare for the test, you see, and get good marks. Life tests you all the time. How deep the teaching has gone in will only be known when you are faced with life's challenges. What is referred to is a series of surprise tests, because we never know what the next moment may bring. That is life. And the depth the teaching has penetrated out deep down, one comes to know in such situations. Buddha's elder cousin, Ananda, did not get his enlightenment during Buddha's lifetime. And many wondered, he was like Buddha's shadow, you see. How would this be possible? That is because, being the elder brother, Ananda put conditions to the Buddha. For example, he said, I will be with you wherever you go, even if it means your bedroom. I will be sleeping in your bedroom. If I introduce you to someone, you must show them the way. And many other such conditions. Became a conditional relationship. And conditions are based on doership. It was only after the Buddha's passing that Ananda could see all this. Conditional love, not surrender. All the yes, but. I agree with you, yes, but. Yes, but. That is the thinking mind of the ego. The trust is not there. And that can only happen, you see. If it is meant to happen, it happens. Now, I would like to read out one question and answer. Rather, one question which will be answered, hopefully. And then after that, depending on this power outage situation, we can take questions if anyone has any questions or would like to share anything. This question I chose, which right now is not in front of me, I'll have to just get it, is so pragmatic, and that is why I love receiving such questions, because they are real, you see. They are people's predicaments. And a teaching which is pragmatic, practical, concerned with daily living, can address such questions. It may not give the answers one wishes to hear, but it throws light on the situation. I will just get it. I believe it's all God's will. Something which I have learned from you and for which I am ever grateful. I am with computers and develop systems. During this lockdown, I had a chance to explore the stock market So I tried and with my mathematical mind developed one very successful technique. I tested it for a month before going real time by putting some decent money into it. My date to start was 1st August. Yesterday, I received this on the 2nd of August. Yesterday, the computer on which I was working crashed and all the data got lost. Though it's in my mind and I can create it again. My big dilemma in all caps, my big dilemma is, just before I could start my work, it got obstructed. Now, if it is God's will, then which of the following three are correct? You see, this is an exam for me. Because after all, it is a mathematical mind. Which of the following three are correct? Number one, the good God did not want me to get into this business as it felt I could be unsuccessful in it. Number two, the bad God did not want me to get into this business as it felt I could be successful in it. Number three, I should forget everything and get the computer repaired, create the system again and move on. I am really confused. I know you are busy, but if you could just tell me whether it is one, two or three, which one is correct, I will move on in life with a clear path. Please do reply. It's very important and I will wait for your answer. You see, this is what happens. We make God into an individual, like a giant sitting in heaven, and give him attributes such as good and bad and so on. Wondering why he did something. I was all set. I developed this system that could make me a lot of money. And then my computer crashed. Is this a sign that I should not go ahead? Does God want me to be successful or not? So the answer is none of the three. The answer is God is the totality of what is. Consciousness, the one source. Now you have been gifted with a mind intellect that enabled this system to be created to crack the stock market. Gifted by that same source. That computer also is developed by that same source. The crashing of that computer also happened because of the will of the source. And the outcome, whether you will take this as a sign and say, maybe I should not go ahead with this, or you may decide to get the computer repaired and go ahead. Whichever happens is also the will of God. And more importantly, the outcome is also the will of God. So it could happen that you repair your computer and you still fail at the stock market despite your abilities. That is also God's will. Or it could happen that you repair the computer and you succeed. That is also God's will. The point is, You have the free will to do precisely that which you think and feel you should do in a given situation. So if you feel that you have mastered a particular system that will enable you to make money, go ahead, but knowing that the results are never guaranteed, just as you had no control over the fact that the computer would crash or not. There are no guarantees in life, and this understanding starts following your in-breath and out-breath. Nothing is guaranteed, nothing is for certain, no outcome is guaranteed in life. If you can accept that no matter how brilliant you are, how well you have cracked this code, it could happen. No matter how slight a chance that you don't make money and you lose money on the stock market, if you can accept that and live with that, then by all means, go ahead. But if you feel that that is going to be hard on me, if I don't succeed, that will be hard. Then decide how hard it will be for you. Will you be wiped out? Will you have sleepless nights and so on? And decide accordingly. So the computer crashing is not going to determine the outcome, but perhaps it is a sign to step back. Hey, look here. Take a look at things again. And thereafter, do precisely that which you think and feel you should do. So this teaching will not tell you that, oh, consider it a sign, don't go ahead. No. You see, that gets very complex. I'll tell you, there was this young, handsome lad, the disciple of a guru, and I got along very well with him. He would come home for dinner whenever he was passing by Mumbai. He was, I think, American. And he fell in love with an Asian girl. They were young, in the mid-20s. And so he went to his guru and said that, we are in love and should we get married? And the guru told him that, for lifetimes you'll have been together and I've seen the last 6 lifetimes of yours together. And that is why you have been drawn to me as the teacher and you all were destined to meet and so on. The signs are very clear. And this marriage has my blessings. And then he said to me that we are getting married in 6 months. As soon as I go back, then I'll fly across. And I said, congratulations, and I really wish you all the best. And I'm glad at least this clarity is there. It's so beautiful. And they broke up after 2 months. Who can know God's will? This is the teaching which empowers you to relax into the knowing that God's will prevails. If you feel powerless, if you feel helpless, know this. It is the ego with its sense of doership that feels powerless. This ego that thought it was in control of its life, was all powerful, that is the one who feels powerless. But this teaching empowers one to know not only that God's will prevails, but to know that nobody is the doer of their actions, including oneself. It is mistaken to feel powerless. You have to question, who is it that says, that stands up and says, I feel powerless? When the light of divine wisdom starts shining, divine wisdom. The ego, with its sense of worship, can't bear it, and it protests. This teaching is making me powerless. So this is the most relevant question. That is why I chose it, rather than some conceptual questions on there is no person here, there is no this, there is no that. Practical, real, as far as daily living is concerned. All right. You can see if there are any questions now.
Hello.
Yes, Aki.
Hi, Gautam. Off late, I've had this question. To begin with, I am myself a devotee of Sai Baba. When I watch movies of Sai Baba or books, when I read books of Sai Baba, I mean, there are examples where Sai Baba has cured people of the diseases. In his in the movie of Sai Baba, he touches a person with leprosy and he gets totally cured. And there are many examples where he has also helped people get relieved from diseases. And in addition to that, from the channel, YouTube channel, Sai Baba Devotee Speaks, we keep hearing about miracles which devotees of Sai Baba have experienced, where people who are in deep financial mess, Sai Baba has got riches back into their lives. Many such stories which we keep hearing about the miracles done by Sai Baba. Now the question is, does Sai Baba do this in alignment with their prarabdha karma? Or is it that Sai Baba does this miracles and changes the prarabdha karma of those individuals? If the latter is true, then what Ramana Maharshi says, again, doesn't hold the significance, because Ramana Maharshi says, do whatever, you cannot change the prarabdha karma, and the main reason why you have taken birth is to exhaust that prarabdha karma for that birth. And even Sai Baba, in certain teachings, he says, the prarabdha karma has to be faced and experienced. So somewhere there is a conflict in what devotees of Sai Baba themselves quote about it, saying that Sai Baba has changed this for me. Sai Baba has changed my life. He's changed me from poor to riches. He's cured my diseases. But at the same time, I remember you yourself saying a wonderful statement, saying that if that was always true, people who are really poor, below the poverty line, they would have prayed to Sai Baba with a very genuine intent, but they're still in the poverty line and they don't see any improvement happening. So somewhere, Gautam, if you can throw more light on that, I'm sure it will really be helpful.
Sure. You see, you already answered this question by saying what you said, that not everyone is the recipient of such grace. Therefore, and even Sai Baba himself has not healed everyone. You see, only those stories of healing have got recorded, right? And he himself has gone on record to say that you have to face your prarabdha. So now, if we keep the individual, Sai Baba as an individual aside, because I truly believe he was a ray of the absolute, Parabrahman. Let's say grace was bestowed on certain individuals, and the outcome was of healing. That is their prarabdha. Please understand this point, that destiny is what is. Destiny is what is. If they were meant to be at a master's feet and they were meant to get healed by the master, they would be healed. That is why there is a very famous story of a lady bringing her son to Ramana Maharshi, her son who was lifeless, placing the child before Ramana, and the child got healed. And then when they asked Ramana, what did he do? He was as astonished as them. He said there was not even a sankalpa. There was not even a wish for the child to get healed. But by merely bringing the child into Bhagwan's presence, this child got healed. You see, and Akhi, what you have raised is so important because I received an email a week ago from someone who has a physically challenged child. And she is a Sai Baba devotee. And her only hope is to pray for miracle from Sai Baba to make the child fine. Now tell me, is there any guarantee that the child will become okay, that a miracle will be performed? Oh, why not accept first that this was destined to happen, and whether or not the child is healed is Baba's will. But if already on the suffering that has been created by the divine, because you have been given a physically challenged child, which you are finding very hard to bring up. If that is clouded all the time with an outcome which you would like to have, and fairly and naturally so. But what happens to daily living? What happens to your dealing with the child during that process, in the here and now, in the present moment? Are you in denial? Are you in conflict? Or have you accepted that if this is meant to happen, even this has to be Baba's will? This has to be God's will. You see, this point is missed, because what happens is many people who are suffering, they get mired in their suffering, they get lost in it, they go into wheels upon wheels upon wheels in the hope that a miracle will be performed and then everything will be bright and shining and beautiful. And this I see happening very often. Whereas what this teaching says is, have faith in God, knowing that whatever happens is His will. That is the faith. That is what should be the trust in one's master, that he or she knows best.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Gautam, and one more point. As you mentioned today, earlier, that the free will which we have is to do what we think we should be doing. So my point is, the thoughts which come to us telling us to do this action, those thoughts are also predestined and predetermined thoughts. Is my understanding correct?
Yes, they are not your thoughts. Thoughts come, and it has been even proven that thoughts come from outside. What happens is the ego gets involved in that thought and stretches it in the duration of time into thinking. That is what happens.
So whatever we think is the free will which we have in terms of doing what we feel like doing, that's actually not free will, because we were destined to do that action. Those thoughts have come and they are actually making us do that action which was already destined to be performed by us. Correct?
Yes, but while we may know this, while we may know that my free will is truly not my free will, also because it depends on two factors which have never been in my control. My genetics, my genes, and my conditioning, over neither of which I have had any control in the past. My free will, which enables me to take decisions, is based on these two factors which God made. So is it my free will? So you know now that it looks like it is my free will, but in truth, it is not. But yet, free will is the mechanism of functioning in daily living. I must take decisions. Do I turn left? Do I turn right? Now what happens with the understanding, Akhi? I know that whether I turned left or right was God's will. I had to exercise my free will as a mechanic in daily living, knowing that it was my destiny to turn right, so I turned right. You see? You see how relaxing and how stress-free this approach can be? Because what would happen? normally you would beat yourself up. Oh my God, I made a mistake by turning right. Because I turned right, I happened to see this accident and it really upset me. Why did I turn right? I should not have turned right. All that dialogue is finished. Because now you know you were meant to turn right. You exercised your free will to turn right. And you were meant to. Thereafter, what happened is not in your control. Just as the turning right was really not in your control. You start relaxing more and more into the interconnectedness of life's events. That is the gift of this teaching. Isn't it so beautiful?
True, true, Gautam.
All right.
Gautam, one last small one. Ramana Maharshi says that when you truly surrender to the divine, all the actions get performed automatically through you. So on the contrary, even if somebody doesn't surrender to the divine and thinks he's the doer, there wouldn't be any change in the actions, right? The actions anyways which were predestined to happen will still keep happening. So what is the difference which Ramana Maharshi wanted to quote by saying when you truly surrender to the divine, you will realize that all the actions are getting performed automatically through you? Because there is no change in the course of actions which would have taken place if the individual has still not surrendered, right? The actions still remain the same is the understanding. Is it correct?
Yes, but that is also the biggest difference. You are absolutely right. But the biggest difference is now onwards, if I live my life with knowing that nobody is truly the doer of their actions, what happens? Because of this new attitude, feelings and emotions like hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, pride, arrogance, guilt, and shame, they no longer are part of my consciousness. You see, this is called living the surrendered life. Whatever is meant to happen will happen. Whatever action is meant to happen will happen by all means. But when I truly live this understanding that all there is consciousness, there is no room for this misconception that people are the doers of their actions. And therefore, all this garbage gets tossed aside. It is a very important difference. Because then you are not living your life, but life is being lived through you. The you as an individual, which had judgments and opinions and so on, and blamed and hated people, that has got annihilated. And then you live the real life, the second birth. That is what Bhagwan was pointing at, you see. So it is both ways. It is a double-edged sword. It is truly a new way of living. So he was no fool to tell people this. It is a shift which is being pointed at. A tectonic shift in one's attitude to life, to other people, to the events that transpire in one's life, to one's relationship with life. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aki. Beautiful questions, as always.
Thank you.
Yes, is that Aiden?
Hi, Gautam. Can you hear me?
I can. Have I pronounced your name correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Are you French?
Actually, I'm from South Africa.
South Africa, okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's nice to finally talk to you, Gautam.
You too.
Gautam, my question is kind of following from what you said previously. And to use an example is, I have like a lot of anxiety and it seems to be getting more pronounced, you could say. So the thing I usually do to calm down or relax myself is to ask to who is this anxiety happening to, or who is the victim of it. And that usually helps for a bit, but it always comes back. So my question is, should I just proceed like this and try to accept or investigate? Or is there maybe something else I'm missing?
Aiden, are you under any medication for the anxiety or any other kind of treatment?
No, I've tried medication a while back, but I don't feel like it's really working. So
Okay. So thank you for this question, because I think many people are feeling anxiety, particularly over the last 4 months, as we all know. So it's a very pertinent question. We can explore this in 2-3 different ways. See, Aiden, whatever you focus on becomes bigger. So the downside of this approach, if we could call it that, is if you keep focusing on your anxiety all the time, you're making it more and more the center point of your attention, and you're giving it more reality than what it already is. For example, if in my life there's someone I don't like, and I keep thinking of that person all the time, my entire attention is now on this enemy of mine, you see? So therefore, the sages say that when anxiety arises, for example, do not fight it. First step is not to say it should be there or it should not be there. It is there. It is a part of what is. Fear is there, a part of what is. All that can be done is the witnessing of it. You see, witnessing is passive. To focus on the anxiety and to all the time look at it is an active process. Therefore, the whole point here is that, of course, anxiety is there. I can't brush it under the carpet. I cannot say it is an illusion, and so on and so forth. And as you explained, that is a very right step to take initially, to look at it, see who is it that is feeling anxious. But what could happen, Aiden, is it can get stuck at an intellectual exercise. If there is a teaching that appeals to you, or a teacher that appeals to you, and you feel it without too much of the intellect understanding it or absorbing it. You feel it in your heart, so to speak. Trust that to show you the way through this anxiety. Because what can happen is focusing on anxiety can make one even more anxious. But when we look at anxiety in objectivity, that it is the nature of an ego, which is fear-based, to be anxious. When we start embracing the anxiety, we start accepting it as one part of ourselves, which we did not create. God, the source consciousness, created it. When we start accepting and embracing it with that dimension, a shift can happen. You see, the whole point is you did not choose to be anxious. You did not create your anxiety. It happened because of life's circumstances, events, your conditioning, and maybe genetics. The whole point is we are trying to destroy something we did not create in the first place, Aiden. We become obsessed with that, and we then make it into a monster. So it has to be looked at with compassion, with neutrality, with objectivity, not something to be rejected. And something you know, this was God's will. Being anxious was God's will. And maybe I will come across a teaching, a teacher, something which resonates within me, which will not remove my anxiety, which will make me see anxiety as an aspect out of many aspects of life's myriad feelings and emotions which one is experiencing. That way, the obsession is over with the anxiety.
Very beautiful, Gautam. Thank you.
And then you become anxious for the grace of the divine. Your anxiety changes into more elevated anxiety, so to speak. That is why they say the mystics would always be chanting God's names. You know, the poets, the mystics, they were just, I mean, I know anxious is not the right word, but to just be bonded with the divine was their sole agenda. And then whatever happened in their life, they were abused, they were condemned, they were called mad, that all became irrelevant. They became irrelevant. When anxiety is seen as the part of the living dream of life, it starts losing its relevance, you see. That is what happens. Okay?
Yeah, thank you so much, Gautam.
Okay. So surprisingly, we are still okay with the power outage. It's 11:38, so if it goes, I think anytime now onwards, then I think we will not resume this meeting. But if it does go soon, just now, for example, it would be nice to just keep still for a couple of minutes before you get up and do your whatever you are supposed to be doing. There are many people who are not even aware that they are anxious. To be aware that one is anxious is the first step. Yes, Bhadra.
Hi, sir.
Good morning. Morning.
So I spoke to you about the karma basically, but I want you to talk more on karma if you can. Like, how did it all begin, you know, like my first karma, you know, like, should I even worry about karma?
I think forget about it. Why do you want to worry about something? Would anyone tell you, yes, you should worry about karma? You should worry about the one who worries about karma. Forget it.
I mean, what do you think?
But Bhadra, the whole point is, if you resonate with a teaching like this one, and in your own life, you start seeing that you are no longer pointing fingers at people or yourself for things and events that have happened in your life, in that process itself, the karma is ending. You see, karma on its own means just action, pure action. What has happened is that karma, which is pure action, has been overlaid with a sense of doership. He did this and she did this and I did this. So when a teaching like this finds its way to your heart and you start seeing your relationships transform in terms of how you thought of people before or yourself and now how you think, in that sense, the karma is changing because the sting and burden of doership is no longer part of that karmic baggage. And that part of the karmic baggage is what perpetuates karma. Action and reaction, action and reaction, action and reaction, blaming people all the time, blaming yourself all the time. That is what keeps the karmic cycle going. If all that stops, where is it going to go? You see, take a simple example. If two people are arguing with one another, verbally arguing, you said this and therefore I did this. No, no, you said this, therefore I did this. No, no, you said this. That tennis match is action and reaction, which perpetuates karma. It's going on and on in a loop. Now, supposing you are one of the two people and you just accept, look, this person said what they said because it was the way they've been made by God, it's destiny, God's will, whatever. That perpetuating of the cycle is going to stop because you have accepted it. You may not agree with it. You may tell the person, I don't agree with it. But going on and on and on and on, that process is finished for you because you accepted certain things. You've said what you had to say. You no longer find the need to defend your position and keep getting sucked into this karmic drama again and again. All that is finished for you. So what happens? Can a tennis match be played only with one person on one side? No. Therefore, what happens? The action-reaction loop is now finished. The karma in that relationship cannot go further, cannot perpetuate further. Because the teaching has come in and has chopped off the involvement in that bondage, Rinanubandhan, in that bondage of that relationship is finished. So in that sense, the teaching brings about the end of karma in terms of doership. Otherwise, the fact that we have taken physical birth is a karmic fact. Otherwise, the birth would not have happened. That has to be lived out as part of the process of karma. Ramana Maharshi had cancer as part of the process of karma. We can attribute various causes to it, that, oh, he was Bhagwan and he took on the sins of the devotees, blah, 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 which is again in the realm of cause and effect and all that. But when the body form is taken, it can only happen when there is karma to go through. The whole point is that why is it that the sage, for him, the karma does not operate anymore? Because he is liberated from this bondage of relationships. So he yet has to live his life, and whatever the next moment brings, it will bring. Even the Buddha had to eat poisoned pork in order to die, you see. So that is the part of living. That cannot be avoided. The whole point is that teachings come along which cut out the drama and the involvement and the identification with all this. That is what happens. Yeah? Okay? For those of you who are following the Master Shirdi Sai Baba, there is a special Zoom being organized for the channel Sai Baba Devotee Speaks. For those who are in France or perhaps know people who are speaking French, there is a session organized with a French translation coming up. I think that is on 6th September, but a notification will go out soon. And meanwhile, these Sunday gatherings they are continuing in August for sure. And we have to see what September brings. And of course, what August brings, we never know. So as of now, they are continuing. All right. I'm going to change the view so I can see all of y'all and we can sit in silence for some time. This whole thought of reincarnation. We are reincarnating every time when we hate, blame, condemn, judge. We are reincarnating the me with its sense of doership. The reincarnation is happening right now. not in another birth. The reincarnation of the me is happening every time we blame ourselves, condemn ourselves, judge ourselves, hate ourselves. When all that starts stopping, the reincarnating does not happen anymore. You see, we can go into this in a separate Zoom talk, but even at death, what happens is that the subtle body, the body of the vasanas and the samskaras, the tendencies, desires, and so on, that bundle does not dissolve. It is that bundle which reincarnates. That is why Maharaj would say that you have to even drop the subtle body. The physical body is just one of the sheets. When he said drop the subtle body, this is what he meant. Now, there's been much argument about rebirth and ego. The ego dies with the death of the body. It all depends on the definition of the word ego. People have different definitions. Now, if ego is the personality, of course it dies with the death of the body. But some people consider, some masters from the Indian tradition consider that bundle of samskaras and vasanas to be the ego. So in that sense, that continues. So let's not get fixed on definitions of the ego. The point remains that when that is dropped itself, there's nothing left to take rebirth, you see. There's nothing left to incarnate into another birth. So forget doing a favor to yourself. It's a favor to consciousness as a whole that consciousness is itself doing. When that bundle of unresolved issues, mental baggage, blame and accusation, when that is not still there in its subtle form, when the body drops away, that is the work of the great teachings. The work of the great teachings is to pierce through that invisible sheath. So that on the manifest level, you lead a life of peace, calm, and harmony with what is. And when that is pierced, when the sheets are pierced, the sword reaches the innermost sheath, the Anandamaya Kosha. Then there is no question of rebirth. No matter what theory you follow, what system you believe in, because it is now, here and now, in this moment. The pure, pristine, conscious presence of being. I am. Is here now, not tomorrow, not after death. Eden, what you focus on is what you become. That is why the masters say, if you focus on God, you can become God. And Maharaj would say, focus on just your sense of being, your sense of presence. Then your whole consciousness will be full of just being. Don't be wanting to be not anxious, because that creates the anxiety for anything, for anyone for that matter. Someone asked Maharaj, used to smoke his bidis quite passionately. And one disciple said, Maharaj, all that you are, you seem to be attached to smoking. And he replied, he said, you seem to be attached to not smoking. Let it all go, you know. It's just not, it really doesn't matter. In the larger picture, nothing really matters. When I read this in one of Rameshji's books, I was so relieved because deep down I knew it was true. Of course, everything matters to the me. With its sense of doership, everything matters. It doesn't matter before you were born. It won't matter after you die. It doesn't matter in your deep sleep. So what is left is a small fraction of what we call daily living, in which everything seems to matter and becomes so monstrous and real. But when you look at the larger picture, it's quite a joke. As Rameshji would say, a cosmic joke.